day, the newspaper singled out Chauncey Depew, president of the New York Central, for a particularly caustic appraisal. Mr. Depew all along has posed as the special friend of the World's Fair and has been lavish in his declarations that his roads would do the fair thing and would enable tens of thousands to come here beyond Niagara Falls. Yet Depew had failed to do what he promised, the Tribune said. It is in order for Chauncey M. Depew to hand in his resignation as Chicago's adopted son. Chicago wants no more of him. Frank Millet, meanwhile, stepped up his own efforts to promote the fair and arranged an increasingly exotic series of events. He organized boat races in the basin of the Court of Honor that pitted inhabitants of the Midway villages against one another. They did battle every Tuesday evening in vessels native to their homelands. "We want to do something to liven up the lagoons and basin," Millet told an interviewer. "People are getting tired of looking at the electric launches. If we can get the Turks, the South Sea Islanders, the Cingalese, the Eskimos, and the American Indians to float about the Grand Basin in their native barks, it will certainly add some novelty as well as interest to the scene." Millet also organized swim meets between the Midway types, as the press called them. He scheduled these for Fridays. The first race took place August 11th in the lagoon, with Zulus swimming against South American Indians. The Dahomans also competed, as did the Turks, some of them as hairy as gorillas, the Tribune said, with the anthropological abandon common to the age. The races were notable for the lack of clothing worn by the contestants and the serious way in which they went at the task of winning $5 gold pieces. Millet's big coup was the Great Midway Ball, held on the night of Wednesday, August 16th. The Tribune called it the Ball of the Midway Freaks and sought to whet the nation's appetite with an editorial that first noted a rising furor within the Board of Lady Managers over the belly dancers of the Midway. Whether the apprehensions of the good ladies were due to infringements of morality or to the anticipation that the performers may bring on an attack of peritonitis if they persist in their contortions is not clear. But all the same, they have taken the position that what is not considered very much out of the way on the banks of the Nile or in the marketplaces of Syria is entirely improper on the Midway between Jackson and Washington Parks. But now, the Tribune continued, the belly dancers and every other depraved, jiggling, half-dressed woman of the Midway had been invited to the Great Ball, where they were expected to dance with the senior officers of the fair, including Burnham and Davis. The situation, therefore, as will be seen, is full of horrifying possibilities, the Tribune said. It should cause a shiver in the composite breast of the Board of Lady Managers when they consider what may happen if Director General Davis should lead out some fascinating Fatima at the head of the grand procession, and she should be taken with peritonitis in the midst of the dance, or if Potter Palmer should escort a votary of the Temple of Luxor, only to find her with the same ailment, or if Mayor Harrison, who belongs to all nations, should dance with the whole lot. Will they suppress their partners' contortions by protest or by force, or, following the fashion of the country, will they too attempt Oriental contortions? Suppose that President Higginbotham finds as his vis-a-vis an anointed, barebacked Fiji beauty or a Dahomeyite Amazon bent upon the extraordinary antics of the cannibal dance. Is he to join in and imitate her or risk his head in an effort to restrain her? Further enriching the affair was the presence at Jackson Park of George Francis Train, known universally as Citizen Train, in his white suit, red belt, and red Turkish fez, invited by Millet to host the ball and the boat and swim races, and anything else that Millet could devise. Train was one of the most famous men of the day, though no one knew quite why. He was said to have been the model for Phileas Fogg, the globetrotter in Around the World in 80 Days. Train claimed the real reason he was invited was to save the fair by using his psychic powers to increase attendance. These powers resided in his body in the form of electrical energy. He walked about the fairgrounds, rubbing his palms to husband that energy, and refused to shake hands with anyone lest the act discharge his potency. Chicago built the fair, he said. Everybody else tried to kill it. Chicago built it. I am here to save it, and I'll be hanged if I haven't. The ball took place in the fair's natatorium, a large building on the midway devoted to swimming and bathing, and equipped with a ballroom and banquet rooms. Bunting of yellow and red hung from the ceiling. The galleries that overlooked the ballroom were outfitted with opera boxes for fair officials and socially prominent families. Burnham had a box, as did Davis and Higginbotham, and, of course, the Palmers. The galleries also had seats and standing room for other paying guests. From railings in front of the boxes hung triangles of silk embroidered with gold arabesques, all glowing with the light of adjacent incandescent bulbs. The effect was one of indescribable opulence. The retrenchment committee would not have approved. At 9:15 that night, Citizen Train, dressed in his usual white but now for some reason carrying an armful of blooming sweet pea, led the procession of exotics, many barefoot, down the stairway of the natatorium to the ballroom below. He held the hand of a 10-year-old Mexican ballerina and was followed by scores of men and women in the customary clothing of their native cultures. Saul Bloom kept order on the ballroom floor. The official program dedicated dances to particular officials and guests. Director General Davis was to lead a quadrille, Burnham a berlin, Mayor Harrison a polka. Once the dances were completed, the crowd was to sing Home Sweet Home. It was hot. Chief Rain in the Face, the Sioux chief who killed Custer's brother and now occupied Sitting Bull's cabin in the midway, wore green paint that streamed down his face. A Laplander wore a fur shirt. Eskimo women wore blouses of walrus skin. The Maharaja of Kapurthala, visiting that week from India, sat in a makeshift throne on the ballroom stage, fanned by three servants. The ballroom burst with color and energy. Japanese in red silk, Bedouins in red and black, Romanians in red, blue, and yellow. Women who ordinarily would have come wearing almost nothing, like Ahiz, an Amazon, and Zatubi, a Dahomen, were given short skirts constructed of small American flags. The Tribune, in an unintended parody of its own penchant for describing the gowns of the rich, noted that Lola, a South Sea Islander, wore her native costume of bark cloth covering about half the body, with low-cut and sleeveless bodice. As the night wore on and the wine flowed, the line to dance with Lola grew long. Sadly, the belly dancers came in robes and turbans. Men in black dress suits circled the floor, swinging black Amazons with bushy hair and teeth necklaces. Chicago, and perhaps the world, had never seen anything like it. The Tribune called the ball the strangest gathering since the destruction of the Tower of Babel. There was food, of course. The official menu? Relishes. Hard-boiled potatoes a la Irish Village. International hash a la Midway Plaisance. Cold dishes. Roast missionary a la Dahomey, west coast of Africa. Jerked buffalo a la Indian Village. Stuffed ostrich, a la Ostrich Farm. Boiled camel humps, a la Cairo Street. Monkey stew, a la Hagenbeck. Entrees. Fricassee of reindeer, a la Lapland. Fried snowballs, a la Ice Railway. Crystallized frappé, from Libby Glass Exhibit. Pastry. Wind donuts, a la Captive Balloon. Sandwiches, assorted, especially prepared by the leather exhibit. And for dessert, the program said, 25% of gross receipts. The ball ended at 4:30 a.m. The exotics walked slowly back to the midway. The guests climbed into their carriages and slept or softly sang After the Ball, the hit song of the day, as their liverymen drove them home over empty streets that echoed with the plosive rhythm of hooves on granite. The ball and Frank Millet's other inventions imparted to the exposition a wilder, happier air. The exposition by day might wear a chaste gown of white staff, but at night it danced barefoot and guzzled champagne. Attendance rose. The daily average of paid admissions for August was 113,403, at last topping the vital 100,000 threshold. The margin was slim, however, and the nation's economic depression was growing steadily worse, its labor situation more volatile. On August 3rd, a big Chicago bank, Lazarus Silverman, failed. Burnham's firm had long been a client. On the night of August 10th, Charles J. Eddy, a former top official of the bankrupt Reading Railroad, one of the first casualties of the panic, walked into Washington Park just north of the Midway and shot himself. Of course, he had been staying at the Metropole. He was the third of the hotel's guests to commit suicide that summer. Mayor Harrison warned that the ranks of the unemployed had swollen to an alarming degree. "If Congress does not give us money, we will have riots that will shake this country," he said. 2 weeks later, workers scuffled with police outside City Hall. It was a minor confrontation, but the Tribune called it a riot. A few days after that, on August 30th, 25,000 unemployed workers converged on the downtown lakefront and heard Samuel Gompers, standing at the back of Speaker's Wagon No. 5, ask, "Why should the wealth of the country be stored in banks and elevators while the idle workman wanders homeless about the streets and the idle loafers, who hoard the gold only to spend it in riotous living, are rolling about in fine carriages from which they look out on peaceful meetings and call them riots?" For the city's industrialists and merchant princes who learned of Gompers' speech in their Sunday morning newspapers, this was a particularly unsettling question, for it seemed to embody a demand for much more than simply work. Gompers was calling for fundamental change in the relationship between workers and their overseers. This was dangerous talk, to be suppressed at all costs. Prendergast. It was exciting, this prospect of becoming one of the city's most important officials. At last, Prendergast could leave behind the cold mornings and filthy streets and the angry newsboys who disobeyed him and taunted him. He was growing impatient, however. His appointment as corporation counsel should have occurred by now. One afternoon in the first week of October, Prendergast took a grip car to City Hall to see his future office. He found a clerk and introduced himself. Incredibly, the clerk did not recognize his name. When Prendergast explained that Mayor Harrison planned to make him the city's new corporation counsel, the clerk laughed. Prendergast insisted on seeing the current counsel, a man named Krauss. Certainly Krauss would recognize his name. The clerk went to get him. Krauss emerged from his office and extended his hand. He introduced Prendergast to the other men on his staff as his successor. Suddenly, everyone was smiling. At first, Prendergast thought the smiling was an acknowledgement that soon he would be in charge. But now he saw it as something else. Krauss asked if he'd like the position immediately. "No," Prendergast said. "I am in no hurry about it." Which was not true, but the question had thrown Prendergast. He did not like the way Krauss asked it. Not at all. Later, an alienist named Daniel R. Brower, former superintendent of the Eastern Lunatic Asylum, would testify that Krauss had erred in humoring Prendergast. By doing so, Dr. Brower said, Krauss had intensified Prendergast's delusion. Toward triumph. By 10 o'clock in the morning on Monday, October 8th, 1893, the day Frank Millet had designated as Chicago Day, ticket takers at the fair's 64th Street gate made an informal count of the morning's sales thus far, and found that this one gate had recorded 60,000 paid admissions. The men knew from experience that on any ordinary day, sales at this gate accounted for about one-fifth the total for any given time, and so came up with an estimate that some 300,000 paid visitors already had entered Jackson Park. More than any other full day's total, and close to the world's record of 397,000 held by the Paris Exposition. Yet the morning had barely begun. The ticket takers sensed that something odd was happening. The pace of admissions seemed to be multiplying by the hour. In some ticket booths, the volume grew so great so quickly that silver coin began piling on the floors and burying the ticket takers' shoes. Millet and other fair officials had expected high attendance. Chicago was proud of its fair, and everyone knew that only 3 weeks remained before it would close forever. To assure maximum attendance, Mayor Harrison had signed an official proclamation that urged every business to suspend operation for the day. The courts closed, as did the Board of Trade. The weather helped, too. Monday was an apple-crisp day with temperatures that never exceeded 62 degrees under vivid cerulean skies. Every hotel had filled to capacity, even beyond capacity, with some managers finding themselves compelled to install cots in lobbies and halls. The Wellington Catering Company, which operated 8 restaurants and 40 lunch counters in Jackson Park, had braced for the day by shipping in 2 train car loads of potatoes, 4,000 half-barrels of beer, 15,000 gallons of ice cream, and 40,000 pounds of meat. Its cooks built 200,000 ham sandwiches and brewed 400,000 cups of coffee. No one, however, expected the sheer crush of visitors that actually did arrive. By noon, the chief of admissions, Horace Tucker, wired a message to fair headquarters, "The Paris record is broken to smithereens, and the people are still coming." A single ticket seller, L.E. Decker, a nephew of Buffalo Bill, who had sold tickets for Bill's Wild West for 8 years, sold 17,843 tickets during his shift, the most by any one man, and won Horace Tucker's prize of a box of cigars. Lost children filled every chair at the headquarters of the Columbian Guard. 19 spent the night and were claimed by their parents the next day. 5 people were killed in or near the fair, including a worker obliterated while helping prepare the night's fireworks, and a visitor who stepped from one grip car right into the path of another. A woman lost her foot when a surging crowd knocked her from a train platform. George Ferris, riding his wheel that day, looked down and gasped, "There must be a million people down there." The fireworks began at 8 o'clock sharp. Millet had planned an elaborate series of explosive set pieces, fireworks affixed to large metal frames shaped to depict various portraits and tableaus. The first featured the Great Fire of 1871, including an image of Mrs. O'Leary's fabled cow kicking over a lantern. The night boomed and hissed. For the finale, the fair's pyrotechnicians launched 5,000 rockets all at once into the black sky over the lake. The true climax occurred after the grounds closed, however. In the silence, with the air still scented with exploded powder, collectors accompanied by armed guards went to each ticket booth and collected the accumulated silver, 3 tons of it. They counted the money under heavy guard. By 1:45 a.m., they had an exact total. Ferris had nearly gotten it right. In that single day, 713,646 people had paid to enter Jackson Park. Only 31,059, 4%, were children. Another 37,380 visitors entered using passes and brought the total admission for the day to 751,026, more people than had attended any single day of any peaceable event in history. The Tribune argued that the only greater gathering was the massing of Xerxes' army of over 5 million souls in the 5th century BC. The Paris record of 397,000 had indeed been shattered. When the news reached Burnham's shanty, there were cheers and champagne and stories through the night. But the best news came the next day, when officials of the World's Columbian Exposition Company, whose boasts had been ridiculed far and wide, presented a check for $1.5 million to the Illinois Trust and Savings Company, and thereby extinguished the last of the exposition's debts. The Windy City had prevailed. Now Burnham and Millett made final arrangements for Burnham's own great day, the grand closing ceremony of October 30th that would recognize once and for all that Burnham really had done it, and that his work was now complete, that for once there was nothing left to do. At this point, Burnham believed, nothing could tarnish the fair's triumph or his own place in architectural history. Departures. Frank Millett expected the closing ceremony to attract even more people than the fair's Chicago day. While Millett did his planning, many of the other men who had helped Burnham construct the fair began the return to ordinary life. Charles McKim disengaged reluctantly. For him, the fair had been a brilliant light that for a time dispelled the shadows that had accumulated around his life. He left Jackson Park abruptly on the morning of October 23rd, and later that day wrote to Burnham, "You know my dislike for saying goodbye, and were prepared to find that I had skipped this morning. To say that I was sorry to leave you all is to put it only one half as strongly as I feel. You gave me a beautiful time, and the last days of the fair will always remain in my mind, as were the first, especially identified with yourself. It will be pleasant for the rest of our natural lives to be able to look back to it and talk it over and over and over again, and it goes without saying that you can depend upon me in every way as often hereafter as you may have need of me." The next day, McKim wrote to a friend in Paris of the deepening consensus among himself, Burnham, and most of Chicago, that the fair was too wonderful a thing to be allowed simply to fall into disrepair after its official closure on October 30th, just 6 days hence. Indeed, it is the ambition of all concerned to have it swept away in the same magical manner in which it appeared, and with the utmost dispatch. For economy, as well as for obvious reasons, it has been proposed that the most glorious way would be to blow up the buildings with dynamite. Another scheme is to destroy them with fire. This last would be the easiest and grandest spectacle, except for the danger of flying embers in the event of a change of wind from the lake. Neither McKim nor Burnham truly believed the fair should be set aflame. The buildings, in fact, had been designed to maximize the salvage value of their components. Rather, this talk of conflagration was a way of easing the despair of watching the dream come to an end. No one could bear the idea of the White City lying empty and desolate. A cosmopolitan writer said, "Better to have it vanish suddenly in a blaze of glory than fall into gradual disrepair and dilapidation. There is no more melancholy spectacle than a festal hall, the morning after the banquet, when the guests have departed and the lights are extinguished." Later, these musings about fire would come to seem like prophecy. Olmsted, too, severed his connection. Toward the end of summer, his busy schedule and the stifling heat caused his health to fail once again and reactivated his insomnia. He had many projects underway, chief among them Biltmore, but he felt himself nearing the end of his career. He was 71 years old. On September 6th, 1893, he wrote to a friend, Fred Kingsbury, "I can't come to you, and often dream of a ride through our old haunts and meeting you and others, but have pretty well surrendered to fate. I must flounder along my way to the end. Olmsted did, however, allow himself a rare expression of satisfaction. I enjoy my children, he told Kingsbury. They are one of the centers of my life, the other being the improvement of scenery and making the enjoyment of it available. Spite of my infirmities, which do drag me cruelly, I am not to be thought of as an unhappy old man. Lewis Sullivan, engorged with praise and awards for his transportation building, especially its golden door, again took up his work with Dankmar Adler, but under changed circumstances. The deepening depression and missteps by the two partners had left the firm with few projects. For all of 1893, they would complete only two buildings. Sullivan, never easy on his peers, became furious with one of the firm's junior architects when he discovered the man had been using his free time to design houses for clients of his own. Sullivan fired him. The junior man was Frank Lloyd Wright. 10,000 construction workers also left the fair's employ and returned to a world without jobs, already crowded with unemployed men. 10,000 construction workers also left the fair's employ and returned to a world without jobs, already crowded with unemployed men. Once the fair closed, many thousands more would join them on Chicago's streets. The threat of violence was as palpable as the deepening cold of autumn. Mayor Harrison was sympathetic and did what he could. He hired thousands of men to clean streets and ordered police stations opened at night for men seeking a place to sleep. Chicago's Commercial and Financial Chronicle reported, "Never before has there been such a sudden and striking cessation of industrial activity." Pig iron production fell by half, and new rail construction shrank almost to nothing. Demand for rail cars to carry visitors to the exposition had spared the Pullman Works, but by the end of the fair, George Pullman, too, began cutting wages and workers. He did not, however, reduce the rents in his company town. The white city had drawn men and protected them. The black city now welcomed them back. On the eve of winter, with filth, starvation, and violence. Holmes, too, sensed it was time to leave Chicago. The pressure from creditors and families was growing too great. First, he set fire to the top floor of his castle. The blaze did minimal damage, but he filed a claim for $6,000 on a policy acquired by his fictional alter ego, Hiram S. Campbell. An investigator for one of the insurance companies, F.G. Cowie, became suspicious and decided to begin a detailed investigation. Though he found no concrete evidence of arson, Cowie believed Holmes or an accomplice had started the fire. He advised the insurers to pay the claim, but only to Hiram S. Campbell, and only if Campbell presented himself in person. Holmes could not claim the money himself, for by now Cowie knew him. Ordinarily, he simply would have recruited someone else to masquerade as Campbell and claim the money, but of late he had become increasingly wary. The guardians of Minnie Williams had dispatched an attorney, William Capp, to look for Minnie and to protect the assets of her estate. Anna's guardian, the Reverend Dr. Black, had hired a private detective who had come to Holmes's building. And letters continued to arrive from the Sigrins and Smythes and other parents. No one yet had accused Holmes of foul play, but the intensity of this new wave of inquiry was greater, more obliquely accusatory than anything he previously had experienced. Hiram S. Campbell never claimed the money. But Holmes found that Cowie's investigation had a secondary, more damaging effect. In the course of digging up information about Holmes, he had succeeded in stirring up and uniting Holmes's creditors, the furniture dealers and iron suppliers and bicycle manufacturers and contractors, whom Holmes had cheated over the previous 5 years. The creditors now hired an attorney named George B. Chamberlain, counsel for Chicago's Lafayette Collection Agency, who had been pestering Holmes ever since he failed to pay the furnace company for improving his kiln. Later, Chamberlain would claim to be the first man in Chicago to suspect Holmes of being a criminal. In the fall of 1893, Chamberlain contacted Holmes and requested he come to a meeting at his office. Holmes believed he and Chamberlain would be meeting alone, one-on-one, but when Holmes arrived at the office, he found it occupied by 24 creditors and their attorneys, and one police detective. This surprised Holmes, but did not faze him. He shook hands and met the angry gazes of his creditors head-on. Tempers immediately cooled a few degrees. He had that effect. Chamberlain had planned the meeting as a trap to try to shatter Holmes's imperturbable facade, and was impressed with Holmes's ability to maintain his insouciance despite the rancor in the room. Chamberlain told Holmes that altogether he owed the creditors at least $50,000. Holmes adopted his most sober expression. He understood their concerns. He explained his lapses. His ambition had gotten ahead of his ability to pay his debts. Things would have been fine, all the debts resolved, if not for the panic of 1893, which had ruined him and destroyed his hopes, just as it had for countless others in Chicago and the nation at large. Incredibly, Chamberlain saw, some of the creditors nodded in sympathy. Tears filled Holmes's eyes. He offered his deepest, most heartfelt apologies. And he suggested a solution. He proposed to settle his debts by giving the group a mortgage secured by his various properties. This nearly made Chamberlain laugh, yet one of the attorneys present in the room actually advised the group to accept Holmes's offer. Chamberlain was startled to see that Holmes's false warmth seemed to be mollifying the creditors. A few moments earlier, the group had wanted the detective to arrest Holmes the moment he entered the room. Now they wanted to talk about what to do next. Chamberlain told Holmes to wait in an adjacent room. Holmes did so. He waited peacefully. As the meeting progressed and grew heated, the attorney who previously had wanted to accept Holmes's mortgage stepped out of Chamberlain's office and entered the room where Holmes waited, ostensibly for a drink of water. He and Holmes talked. Exactly what happened next is unclear. Chamberlain claimed later that this attorney had been so angry at having his recommendation rebuffed that he tipped Holmes to the fact the creditors were again leaning toward arrest. It is possible, too, that Holmes simply offered the attorney cash for the information, or deployed his false warmth and cheery regret to seduce the attorney into revealing the group's mounting consensus. The attorney returned to the meeting. Holmes fled. Soon afterward, Holmes set out for Fort Worth, Texas, to take better advantage of Minnie Williams's land. He had plans for the property. He would sell some of it, and on the rest build a 3-story structure exactly like the one in Englewood. Meanwhile, he would use the land to secure loans and float notes. He expected to lead a very prosperous and satisfying life, at least until the time came to move on to the next city. He brought along his assistant, Benjamin Pitizel, and his new fiancée, the small and pretty Miss Georgiana Yoke. Just before leaving Chicago, Holmes acquired a life insurance policy from Fidelity Mutual Life of Philadelphia to insure Pitizel's life for $10,000. Nightfall. Throughout October, attendance at the fair rose sharply as more and more people realized the time left to see the White City was running short. On October 22nd, paid attendance totaled 138,011. Just 2 days later, it reached 244,127. 20,000 people a day now rode the Ferris wheel, 80% more than at the start of the month. Everyone hoped attendance would continue rising and that the number of people drawn to the closing ceremony of October 30th would break the record set on Chicago Day. To attract visitors for the close, Frank Millet planned a day-long celebration with music, speeches, fireworks, and a landing by Columbus himself from the exposition's full-sized replicas of the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria, built in Spain for the fair. Millet hired actors to play Columbus and his captains. The crew would consist of the men who had sailed the ships to Chicago. Millet arranged to borrow tropical plants and trees from the horticultural building and have them moved to the lakeshore. He planned also to coat the beach with fallen oak and maple leaves to signify the fact that Columbus landed in autumn, even though live palms and dead deciduous leaves were not precisely compatible. Upon landing, Columbus was to thrust his sword into the ground and claim the New World for Spain, while his men assumed positions that mimicked those depicted on a 2-cent postage stamp commemorating Columbus's discovery. Meanwhile, according to the Tribune, Indians recruited from Buffalo Bill's show and from various fair exhibits would peer cautiously at the landing party while shouting incoherently and running to and fro. With this enactment, Millet hoped to carry visitors back 400 years, despite the steam tugboats that would nudge the Spanish ships toward shore. First, however, came Mayor Harrison's big day, American Cities Day, on Saturday, October 28th. 5,000 mayors and city councilmen had accepted Harrison's invitation to the fair, among them the mayors of San Francisco, New Orleans, and Philadelphia. New York's mayor sent his regrets. There was only so much crow that even a city the size of New York could be expected to digest. That morning, Harrison delighted reporters by announcing that, yes, the rumors about him and the very young Miss Annie Howard were true. And not only that, the two planned to marry on November 16th. The glory time came in the afternoon when he rose to speak to the assembled mayors. Friends said he had never looked so handsome, so full of life. He praised the remarkable transformation of Jackson Park. "Look at it now," he said. "These buildings, this hall, this dream of poets of centuries is the wild aspiration of crazy architects alone." He told his audience, "I myself have taken a new lease of life," an allusion perhaps to Miss Howard, "and I believe I shall see the day when Chicago will be the biggest city in America and the third city on the face of the globe." He was 68 years old, but announced, "I intend to live for more than half a century, and at the end of that half century, London will be trembling lest Chicago shall surpass it." With a glance at the mayor of Omaha, he graciously offered to accept Omaha as a suburb. He changed course. "It sickens me when I look at this great exposition to think that it will be allowed to crumble to dust," he said. He hoped the demolition would be quick and quoted a recent remark by Burnham, "Let it go. It has to go, so let it go. Let us put the torch to it and burn it down." I believe with him. If we cannot preserve it for another year, I would be in favor of putting a torch to it and burning it down, and let it go up into the bright sky to eternal heaven. Prendergast could stand it no longer. His visit to the Corporation Counsel's office, by rights, his office, had been humiliating. They had humored him, smirked. Yet Harrison had promised him the job. What did he have to do to get the mayor's attention? All his postcards had achieved nothing. No one wrote to him. No one took him seriously. At 2 o'clock on American Cities Day, Prendergast left his mother's house and walked to a shoe dealer on Milwaukee Avenue. He paid the dealer $4 for a used 6-chamber revolver. He knew that revolvers of this particular model had a penchant for accidental discharge when bumped or dropped, so he loaded it with only 5 cartridges and kept the empty chamber under the hammer. Later, much would be made of this precaution. At 3 o'clock, about the time Harrison was giving his speech, Prendergast walked into the Unity Building in central Chicago, where Governor John P. Altgeld had an office. Prendergast looked pale and strangely excited. An official of the building found his demeanor troubling and told him he could not enter. Prendergast returned to the street. It was nearly dark when Harrison left Jackson Park and drove north through the cold, smoky evening toward his mansion on Ashland Avenue. Temperatures had fallen sharply over the week, down to the 30s at night, and the sky seemed perpetually overcast. Harrison reached his home by 7 o'clock. He tinkered with a first-floor window, then sat down to supper with two of his children, Sophie and Preston. He had other children, but they were grown and gone. The supper, of course, included watermelon. In the midst of supper, at approximately 7:30, someone rang the bell at the front door. Mary Hansen, the parlor maid, answered and found a gaunt young man with a smooth-shaven face and close-cut black hair. He looked ill. He asked to see the mayor. By itself, there was nothing peculiar about the request. Evening visits by strangers were a regular occurrence at the Ashland House, for Harrison prided himself on being available to any citizen of Chicago, regardless of social stature. Tonight's visitor seemed seedier than most, however, and behaved oddly. Nonetheless, Mary Hansen told him to come back in half an hour. The day had been an exciting one for the mayor, but also exhausting. He fell asleep at the table. Shortly before 8 o'clock, his son left the dining room to go up to his room and dress for an engagement in the city later that night. Sophie also went upstairs to write a letter. The house was cozy and well lit. Mary Hansen and the other servants gathered in the kitchen for their own supper. At precisely 8 o'clock, the front bell again rang, and again Hansen answered it. The same young man stood at the threshold. Hansen asked him to wait in the hall and went to get the mayor. "It must have been about 8 o'clock when I heard a noise," Harrison's son Preston said. "I was startled. It sounded like a picture falling." Sophie heard it too and heard her father cry out. "I thought nothing of it," she said, "because I thought it was some screens falling on the floor near the back hall. Father's voice I took to be a yawn. He had a way of yawning very loud." Preston left his room and saw smoke drifting up from the entry hall. As he came down the steps, he heard two more reports. "The last shot was clear and penetrating," he said. "I knew it to be a revolver shot. It sounded like a manhole explosion." He ran to the hall and found Harrison lying on his back, surrounded by servants, the air silvered with gun smoke. There was very little blood. Preston shouted, "Father is not hurt, is he?" The mayor himself answered. "Yes," he said. "I am shot. I will die." Three more shots rang from the street. The coachman had fired his own revolver once in the air to alert police, once at Prendergast, and Prendergast had returned the shot. The commotion brought a neighbor, William J. Chalmers, who folded his coat under Harrison's head. Harrison told him he had been shot over the heart, but Chalmers did not believe it. There was too little blood. They argued. Chalmers told Harrison he had not been shot over the heart. Harrison snapped, "I tell you I am. This is death." A few moments later, his heart stopped. "He died angry," Chalmers said, "because I didn't believe him. Even in death, he is emphatic and imperious." Prendergast walked to the nearby Des Plaines Street police station and calmly told Desk Sergeant O.Z. Barber, "Lock me up. I am the man who shot the mayor." The sergeant was incredulous until Prendergast gave him the revolver, which smelled strongly of blown powder. Barber found that its cylinder contained 4 spent cartridges and a single live one. The 6th chamber was empty. Barber asked Prendergast why he had shot the mayor. because he betrayed my confidence. I supported him through his campaign, and he promised to appoint me corporation counsel. He didn't live up to his word. The exposition company canceled the closing ceremony. There would be no Jubilee March, no landing by Columbus, no address by Harlow Higginbotham, George Davis, or Bertha Palmer, no presentation of awards, no praise for Burnham and Olmsted, no Hail Columbia, no mass rendition of Auld Lang Syne. The closing became instead a memorial assembly in the fair's festival hall. As the audience entered, an organist played Chopin's funeral march on the hall's giant pipe organ. The hall was so cold the presiding officer announced that men could keep their hats on. Reverend Dr. J. H. Barrows read a blessing and benediction, and then, at the request of exposition officials, read a speech that Higginbotham had prepared for the originally planned ceremony. The remarks still seemed appropriate, especially one passage. "We are turning our backs upon the fairest dream of civilization and are about to consign it to the dust," Barrows read. "It is like the death of a dear friend." The audience exited slowly into the cold, gray afternoon. At exactly 4:45, sunset, the warship Michigan fired one of its cannon and continued to fire 20 times more as 1,000 men quietly took up positions at each of the exposition's flags. With the last boom of the Michigan's gun, the great flag at the administration building fell to the ground. Simultaneously, the 1,000 other flags also fell, as massed trumpeters and bassoonists in the court of honor played the Star-Spangled Banner and America. 200,000 visitors, many in tears, joined in. The fair was over. The 600 carriages in Carter Harrison's cortege stretched for miles. The procession moved slowly and quietly through a black sea of men and women dressed for mourning. A catafalque carrying Harrison's black casket led the cortege, and was followed immediately by Harrison's beloved Kentucky mare, stirrups crossed on its empty saddle. Everywhere the white flags that had symbolized the white city hung at half-mast. Thousands of men and women wore buttons that said, "Our Carter," and watched in silence as carriage by carriage the city's greatest men drove past. Armour, Pullman, Schwab, Field, McCormick, Sears, Ward, and Burnham. It was a difficult ride for him. He had passed this way before, to bury John Root. The fair had begun with death. It had ended with death. So grand was the procession, it needed 2 hours to pass any one point. By the time it reached Graceland Cemetery north of the city, darkness had fallen and a soft mist hugged the ground. Long lines of policemen flanked the path to the cemetery's brownstone chapel. Off to the side stood 50 members of the United German Singing Societies. Harrison had heard them sing at a picnic and, joking, had asked them to sing at his funeral. Harrison's murder fell upon the city like a heavy curtain. There was the time before, there was the time after. Where once the city's newspapers would have run an endless series of stories about the after effects of the fair, now there was mostly silence. The fair remained open, informally, on October 31st, and many men and women came to the grounds for one last visit, as if paying their respects to a lost relative. A tearful woman told columnist Teresa Dean, "The goodbye is as sad as any I have known in all the years that I have lived." William Stead, the British editor whose brother Herbert had covered the fair's opening, arrived in Chicago from New York on the night of its official close, but made his first visit to the grounds on the 31st. He claimed that nothing he had seen in Paris, Rome, or London was as perfect as the Court of Honor. That night, the exposition illuminated the fair's grounds one last time. Beneath the stars, the lake lay dark and somber, Stead wrote, but on its shores gleamed and glowed in golden radiance the ivory city, beautiful as a poet's dream, silent as a city of the dead. The Black City. The exposition proved unable to hold the Black City at bay for very long. With its formal closure, thousands more workers joined the swelling army of the unemployed, and homeless men took up residence among the great, abandoned palaces of the fair. The poor had come lean and hungry out of the terrible winter that followed the World's Fair, wrote novelist Robert Herrick in The Web of Life. In that beautiful enterprise, the prodigal city had put forth her utmost strength, and having shown the world the supreme flower of her energy, had collapsed. The city's huge garment was too large for it. Miles of empty stores, hotels, flat buildings showed its shrunken state. Tens of thousands of human beings, lured to the festive city by abnormal wages, had been left stranded, without food or a right to shelter in its tenantless buildings. It was the contrast that was so wrenching. What a spectacle, wrote Ray Stannard Baker in his American Chronicle. What a human downfall after the magnificence and prodigality of the World's Fair, which had so recently closed its doors. Heights of splendor, pride, exaltation in one month, depths of wretchedness, suffering, hunger, cold in the next. In that first brutal winter, Burnham's photographer Charles Arnold took a very different series of photographs. One shows the machinery building soiled by smoke and litter. A dark liquid had been thrown against one wall. At the base of a column was a large box, apparently the home of an out-of-work squatter. It is desolation, wrote Teresa Dean, the columnist, about a visit she made to Jackson Park on January 2, 1894. You wish you had not come. If there were not so many around, you would reach out your arms, with the prayer on your lips for it all to come back to you. It seems cruel, cruel to give us such a vision, to let us dream and drift through heaven for 6 months, and then to take it out of our lives. 6 days after her visit, the first fires occurred and destroyed several structures, among them the famous peristyle. The following morning, Big Mary, chipped and soiled, stood over a landscape of twisted and blackened steel. The winter became a crucible for American labor. To workers, Eugene Debs and Samuel Gompers came increasingly to seem like saviors, Chicago's merchant princes like devils. George Pullman continued to cut jobs and wages without reducing rents, even though his company's treasury was flush with over $60 million in cash. Pullman's friends cautioned that he was being pig-headed and had underestimated the anger of his workers. He moved his family out of Chicago and hid his best china. On May 11, 1894, 2,000 Pullman workers went on strike with the support of Debs' American Railway Union. Other strikes broke out around the country, and Debs began planning a nationwide general strike to begin in July. President Cleveland ordered federal troops to Chicago and placed them under the command of General Nelson A. Miles, previously the Grand Marshal of the Exposition. Miles was uneasy about his new command. He sensed in the spreading unrest something unprecedented, more threatening and far-reaching than anything that had occurred before. He followed orders, however, and the former Grand Marshal of the fair wound up fighting the men who had built it. Strikers blocked trains and burned rail cars. On July 5, 1894, arsonists set fire to the 7 greatest palaces of the exposition: Post's immense manufacturers building, Hunt's dome, Sullivan's golden door, all of them. In the loop, men and women gathered on rooftops and in the highest offices of the rookery, the Masonic Temple, the Temperance Tower, and every other high place to watch the distant conflagration. Flames rose 100 feet into the night sky and cast their gleam far out onto the lake. Belatedly, Burnham had gotten his wish. "There was no regret," observed the Chicago Tribune, "rather a feeling of pleasure that the elements and not the wrecker should wipe out the spectacle of the Columbian season." Later, in the next year, came the wonder. There are hundreds of people who went to Chicago to see the fair and were never heard from again, said the New York World. The list of the missing when the fair closed was a long one, and in the greater number, foul play suspected. Did these visitors to the fair, strangers to Chicago, find their way to Holmes's castle in answer to delusive advertisements sent out by him, never to return again? Did he erect his castle close to the fairgrounds so as to gather in these victims by the wholesale? The Chicago police had no answers, other than the obvious. That in Chicago, in the time of the fair, it was so very easy to disappear. Part 4. Cruelty Revealed, 1894 to 1895. Property of H. H. Holmes. Detective Frank Geyer was a big man with a pleasant, earnest face, a large walrus mustache, and a new gravity in his gaze and demeanor. He was one of Philadelphia's top detectives and had been a member of the force for 20 years, during which time he had investigated some 200 killings. He knew murder and its unchanging templates. Husbands killed wives, wives killed husbands. The poor killed one another, always for the usual motives of money, jealousy, passion, and love. Rarely did a murder involve the mysterious elements of dime novels or the stories of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. From the start, however, Geyer's current assignment had veered from the ordinary. One unusual aspect was that the suspect already was in custody, arrested November 17, 1894, for insurance fraud. The suspect was a physician whose given name was Mudgett, but who was known more commonly by the alias H. H. Holmes. He once had lived in Chicago, where he and an associate, Benjamin Pititzel, had run a hotel during the World's Columbian Exposition of 1893. They had moved next to Fort Worth, Texas, then to St. Louis and on to Philadelphia, committing frauds along the way. In Philadelphia, Holmes had swindled the Fidelity Mutual Life Association of nearly $10,000 by apparently faking the death of a policyholder, Ben Pitetzel. Holmes had bought the insurance in 1893 from Fidelity's Chicago office, just before the close of the exposition. As evidence of fraud accumulated, Fidelity had hired the Pinkerton National Detective Agency, the eye that never sleeps, to search for Holmes. The agency's operatives picked up his trail in Burlington, Vermont, and followed him to Boston, where they arranged to have him arrested by police. Holmes confessed to the fraud and agreed to be extradited to Philadelphia for trial. At that point, the case appeared to be closed. But now it was June 1895. 7 months had passed since Holmes's arrest, and it was becoming increasingly apparent that he had not faked the death of Ben Pitetzel. He had killed him, and then arranged the scene to make the death seem accidental. Now, three of Pitetzel's 5 children, Alice, Nellie, and Howard, were missing. Last seen in Holmes's company. Geyer's assignment was to find the children. He was invited to join the case by Philadelphia District Attorney George S. Graham, who over the years had come to rely on Geyer for the city's most sensitive investigations. Graham had thought twice this time, however, for he knew that just a few months earlier Geyer had lost his wife Martha and his 12-year-old daughter Esther in a house fire. Geyer interviewed Holmes in his cell, but learned nothing new. Holmes insisted that when he had last seen the children, they were alive, and traveling with an accomplice named Minnie Williams, en route